Well, welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett, and today I'm joined by Shane Tews, who's an expert on ICANN and internet naming and security. Hello, Shane.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
You've done several podcasts with me before where you were basically the interviewer, so now we're switching roles this time, and you're the expert, and I'm going to pick your brain about what's been going on with this ICANN, the U.S. government contract for the Internet Assigned Names and Numbers Authority, and where all this stuff is going, what it means, and where it's going.
Okay.
What actually changed?
So the IANA function, what it is the core 13 root operators have a very limited number of things they're looking for, and it has to do with the directory function, and it just is very simple. It's .com, .net, .org. There are originally 21, and then we've been adding names, and now we're over 1,000. So it's .bike, .golf, .movie.
Okay, so there's one company that has a contract to manage all of the assignments within a .com domain, right?
Correct.
And so Bennett.com, Google.com, this is all just done by VeriSign, right?
Correct.
And there's another company that has the contract for what, like .info?
.org,
.ngo. And .gov. Those, I think VeriSign actually has
.gov.
.gov, yes. And there's some other. But, for example, .eu or .uk.
Or .us.
There are particular companies that are responsible for ensuring that there aren't any duplicate assignments, and that if they do assign a name to someone who violates the terms and conditions of ownership of one of these domains, then it can be taken away from them. And those are, you know, so they're of the thousands of, basically they're the things that we think of as to the right of the final period in the name. So it's
Correct. Like
www.bennett.com. The final period on the right-hand side of that goes to .com. So somebody handles .com, but then there's sort of an invisible period after .com, and to the right of that is this root zone. So all the top-level, so .com is what's called a top-level domain.
Correct.
All of the top-level domains are elements of this sphere of administration that IANA is responsible for, that essentially ensures the integrity of the top-level domain.
It's a directory.
Yeah.
It's a large list, and what you want to make sure doesn't happen is that nobody is able to, you can't have two RichardBennett.coms. You just want one. You don't want to be feuding with someone else who occasionally gets your email. So Google.com is its own space. Anything .uk is its own space, and that's run by Nominet. And there's several companies that do this. Com was first in the United States. We had a huge commercial ability to promote that. So we don't see much .us, but there's a company named Neustar that runs .us. And then with these new, what they call generic top-level domains, those are the ones that are coming online. And they're slow on the uptake, but part of that is that a lot of people don't type things into the URL bar the way that you used to. So you have search that can find things that are on .camera or .gallery that you used to always assume were a .com. And they're making way.
And so the best way to think about this, I guess, in simple terms, is that every internet domain is a directory, and then there are also directories of these directories. So there's like, so .com by itself is a directory, but then the root zone that includes .com, .org, etc. is another directory.
And that is the IANA function.
And the IANA, so this final directory, this sort of the mother of all the directories, is called the root zone.
Yes.
And it's the one that IANA has always operationally managed that. But it used to be in the past, wasn't it the case that before they could make a modification to the root zone, that it had to be approved by the NTIA, which is part of the U.S. Department of Commerce?
Right. I call it the triangle of trust. There are two things that the IANA function does. They do delegation and redelegation.
Mm-hmm.
So delegation, in the case of we're talking about the new top-level domains, it's adding something new that wasn't in the root before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a new delegation. And then there's a redelegation, which would be actually changing the location of a server that might need to have a new IP number. And that would just need to be approved so you could continue to find it. It was just a matter of changing the address in the directory function.
So if the contractor that had the ran the catalog for .com, if that contract changed, and instead of VeriSign having it and say Neustar got it, then presumably the IP addresses associated with .com would have to change from VeriSign servers to Neustar servers, right?
Yes.
So that would be one of the things that that IANA would take care of.
So when you make that change, you put the request in, it would go to the IANA function staff who happen to reside at ICANN. And what the Department of Commerce staff at NTIA did was just validate that it was within the policy protocols. So they weren't making any actual policy decisions. They were looking to make sure that all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed. That was their only function. There was concern because they were the Department of Commerce, which meant they were part of the U.S. government, even though they never once interfered in the directory service in the function that they did.
Well, I mean, if I'm a non-U.S. citizen and I'm running an international business on the Internet, I think I'd be a little bit concerned about the United States government having a role in how I can run my business. Was that kind of an issue?
It wasn't an issue. It was just a political bone.
Oh, okay. So this is one of these talking points that enabled an issue that was, to me, you know, on the face of it, IANA is the mother of all sort of bureaucratic functions.
That's an interesting way of, it's like adding area codes. At some point, you're going to need more numbers, and so you're going to have to add what we call area codes, yes.
And so the important thing is that, you know, you can't assign, you know, there can't be two different places where you can get the information about what's inside of .com.
That's the point.
There has to be one authority on .com that I go to get that. And if someone else wants to set up their own service, there's actually nothing that prevents them from pretending to be the administrator of .com, right?
Well, what stops them from pretending to be the administrator of .com is that you don't actually point to it. So if they're not in the directory, then it's sort of the www, which most of us don't use anymore. You could do an alternate route and get away from all of this that we're talking about. But if no one will point you there, if your ISP can't find it, or you don't know how to direct yourself there on your own service, it's like it doesn't exist.
Well, but in a sort of a pedantic technical sense, if someone wanted to set up like a rogue DNS, right? I mean, and there was some talk about this when the Stop Online Piracy Act was an issue. There were various activists that wanted to set up a parallel DNS system so that no government could have any control over policies for the assignment of domain names or couldn't use it as an anti-piracy tool or to prevent free speech or anything else. They said, you know, if someone sets up, you know, Bob's DNS, and Bob's DNS is internally configured to use, you know, Roy's version of .com instead of VeriSign's version of .com, I mean, that would still work, right? They could do that?
If you knew how to find it, their challenge would be that the current directory service wouldn't point you there.
Right, but what you'd have to do is the individuals who wanted to use that system would have to open up their TCP parameters on their computers, and instead of letting the domain name service address be set by their ISP, which it is automatically done today, you could hardwire it to go to, you know, to Bob's DNS, right?
You could. It would be a long time before you would have enough people doing it that would make
a
difference.
Yeah, I mean, you probably would, you know, you'd have like, you know, dedicated activists might do that for a while. But as a technical matter, it actually could be done. There's nothing that actually forces people to use the official domain name system.
That's true.
Right. It's just that people do use it because of convenience and practicality and, you know, the benefits that it offers in terms of actually ensuring that, you know, that there aren't what the name collisions are called, where there are two different parties using the same domain name.
Right.
Can be troublesome. So it works because it's a consensus. It works basically because there's a consensus that it that it works and it should work and it's the best way to get this stuff done. But in principle, someone could build an alternate. I mean, once upon a time, there wasn't a domain name system and we could still use the internet. We just had to know. We had to have IP addresses, you know, stored in little text files that people could get to.
It's kind of like phone numbers. Most of us don't know phone numbers anymore.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And so if you have the phone numbers of all your friends memorized, no problem. You don't need a directory.
Right. Yeah. But if your phone knows them and you just push a button, you slowly forget what those phone numbers are because the machine knows them.
Yeah. Yeah. Essentially, it's just the elimination of the Commerce Department's oversight. That's actually what happened. I mean, in a practical sense, the same, the zone file is located in the same place as it was in before. The procedure for updating it is pretty much the same as it was before, with the exception of now you don't have NTIA in the middle of it saying, yes, you can do this, or no, you can't. And they sort of rarely, if ever, said, no, you can't. They always said yes, right?
So they took that validation point out, and what they've replaced it with is an after action. So if you have a concern, you have to go through something after the case. So if you do have something like name collision, you're going to have to create a query at ICANN, and they're still working through that.
Mm-hmm.
There's the idea of how they're going to do authentication and any way that we're going to manage, you know, validating these as a, you know, something that happens before that you might have had the Department of Commerce do or an entity of that. They decided instead that they trust the system. They think the system's working really well. If there's concerns, then you will manage this after the problem exists.
Well, and we've always had those kinds of dispute resolution procedures, right? I mean, because there are frequently have been disagreements about who the rightful owner of a domain might be. Like, you know, should Ford.com be the car company or should it be the owner of the theater, right?
Or the Delta is an example. I think it's because you have Delta Airlines, you have Delta Faucets, you have several people that can lay claim to the intellectual property, or the idea of the name has been long in their standing as a company.
Mm-hmm.
And so why does one get one over the other? When you go into the .com space, it was first come, first serve.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you have these new generic top-level domains, there's actually more guidance to that. There was an application guidebook that's very long, very laborious process where they've tried to manage through a lot of these issues. Governments were much more involved in that, which means that it's a much more cumbersome process.
Mm-hmm.
People who've chosen to get into the domain name system after the .com world are now having to manage through a lot of that guidance. And mm-hmm. so you have interesting situations where .spa, you have a town in Belgium which lays claim to spa. And as long as you're willing to give them a percentage of anything on a .spa name, they were willing to look the other way on their concerns.
Mm.
So it got interesting really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, when the thing at the right side of the final period means something in particular rather than sort of a class of enterprise,
yes,
it gets a lot more contentious. Yeah, I mean, I noticed that one of the assignments is to a company called Ping.
Oh, the golf, yes.
Which makes golfing equipment.
Yeah.
And that's their brand name. It's like Ping, you know, the sound that you make when you hit a golf ball, right?
Right.
But ping has lots of other meanings, too, especially in the internet space. Ping is like a tool that we use to figure things. And it's like, I'll ping you on Tuesday. I mean, it's kind of part of common speech and completely unrelated to golf, right? But so how did they get it?
They put an application in for $185,000 and moved the process forward to within the ICANN process to want access, sole access to the name. So they wouldn't have to share it with anyone.
Okay, so it just highest bidder.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. I guess that works. Works in spectrum. So now we have, and it's good you have that they have post hoc adjudication processes because they're all, you know, disputes can arise pretty much at any time. And that's probably a more effective general solution than trying to catch all the problems before they happen in the first place.
Right? Well, they've done their best in the new process to see what they can do to alleviate there being a problem. But once there is a problem, the problem will actually, it'll go online and then there will have to be a complaint process to get it offline.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the critics within the United States political system, candidate Trump, Senator Cruz, some others, were said that changing, removing NTIA's role from IANA oversight would mean ultimately Russia and China would control the internet.
Well, there are concerns about who runs parts of the system. So with the Internet of Things becoming bigger and there's going to be many more items that are attached to the internet, the question of could you have a government entity that would somehow impede something you were doing was kind of an unknown variable, and there was a lot of fear factor around that. The actual IANA function became a symbolic issue, and so when it went away, I think a lot of people thought these problems were going to get resolved. And then we went into an ITU meeting where it continued to be that they still could refer to it as the U.S. DNS. So I'm not sure how much we resolved. I mean, the question of the U.S. government being engaged is now that's no longer an issue because that contract is dissolved. There's no way to get it back. There's no clawback measure. It is now part of internet history.
Well, so this raises another interesting question, is that ICANN, as a nonprofit corporation that's chartered in California that was created, 20 years ago?
Yes, in 1999 is the green paper became the white paper, and now is a California-based nonprofit.
And so it's the company that ultimately manages, assigns domain names and decides who gets them and sets the policy for it and delegates to all these different little national authorities to do their little part of it.
Yes, and they still are a California-based nonprofit, so they are under California law.
But there are other international organizations like the one you just mentioned, ITU, International Telecommunications Union, which was originally set up in the telegraph era, became part of the UN at some point, added telephony to its remit, has some involvement in things like international spectrum harmonization, does a lot of stuff with telecommunications. And they, as a collection of national regulators, essentially, has had their eye on the internet for a long time. And it, you know, like the FCC is always expanding their range of authority to remain relevant. ITU kind of wants to do that on an international scale, right?
Yes.
And there have been some conflicts about ITU seeking a bigger role for itself in the way the internet functions on a global basis, and other parties not really wanting ITU to get involved, because, you know, for a number of fairly significant reasons, right?
Yeah, so they just had a three-week meeting in Tunisia, and one of the main issues was something called the Domain Object
Digital Object Administration,
yes,
or something.
And it's
DOA.
DOA.
Yeah, interesting acronym.
Well, it's like the Nova car, but yeah.
But
there was a big fight over this, and the U.S. government led the resistance to say that this becomes the new way that we absolutely have to handle Internet of Things. They ITU. There were certain Russians. The Arabs were engaged in this. The Africans had a long discussion about this, of which the American government pushed back and saying there had to be one way to do this. And they were using as the base of this Bob Kahn's handle system. I don't think anybody has any complaint about the actual handle system.
And Bob Kahn, by the way, for the listeners, is one of the people who, along with Vint Cerf, is credited with creating the internet. And Bob Kahn certainly was, I would argue, played the more instrumental role, because he secured the funding for doing the research that led to the creation of TCP/IP and the internet as we know it today really came from that work. So Bob Kahn is a legitimate father of the internet.
And I think that the handle system has a lot of merit. You and I have had a brief conversation about this before, but you had some really interesting visionary thoughts about how you could actually use a handle system to enable security. I don't know if you want to.
Well, and I think Bob's idea is that there's a lot of inefficiency because the internet design is highly modular, and so, which is to say that it's constructed in layers, and there's an assumption that at each functional layer of the internet, there's limited communication with the other functional layers, which has some benefits. So it's had some early benefits in terms of enabling the system to get off the ground when a whole lot of design work, original design work, had to take place. So if you divide the overall system up into these layers, it's sort of a nice bureaucratic organization, because now you can have like one committee of engineers working on the design for Internet Protocol. You can have another committee working on the design for TCP. You can have another committee working on the design for the domain name system. You can have another committee working on the web. And so that, because these are all different modules that get combined together to make a functional internet, it's nice to be able to split them up, have people work on them independently, and then put all the pieces back together. But what Bob Kahn pointed out, and he's been working on this for at least 15, maybe 20 years or more, is there's tremendous inefficiency in the fact that IP addresses represent particular pieces of hardware, particular computers. So the, you know, the iMac on my desktop or whatever has an IP address that stands for the device, but rarely in the use of the internet is it sufficient for you to contact a device. What you actually want is a piece of content. And we don't have a system that essentially allows us to address individual, unique pieces of content, collections of information. So if every movie, for example, had a unique identifier, and I want to watch a movie, then I could request streaming of that movie by its identifier name, and whoever, you know, so various parties that had access to that, that had a copy of that movie, could essentially bid with me and say, well, I'll show it to you for a dollar, I'll show it to you for a dollar and a half, I'll show it to you for free, but I'm going to make you watch a bunch of commercials. And you know, and if it's unlicensed and several of my neighbors happen to have already seen it, I might be able to assemble the movie from, you know, local cache from their computers without even, you know, hitting the internet proper, without ever leaving my neighborhood. So when you have a system of identifiers for the individual content, it and really completes the, it kind of closes the circle. Because, you know, what we have now is like the internet says, I don't care about content, I just care about systems. And so I'll have infrastructure that connects all the systems to the other systems, and what you do with it, I don't care, right? But, well, it turns out we care.
Right.
And so that's Bob's, I mean, I think that's kind of Bob's object identifier concept in a nutshell.
And would there be the ability to do a gating and a security concept along with that?
Well, sure. I mean, if you know, because there, you can have whatever series of hoops you want to impose, you can put those in the system such that before you can get access to the particular piece of content that on the system that you want to get it from, that you have to pay for it. I mean, that, you know, that's one thing that can happen. And where it really becomes useful, I think, is in the prevention of certain kinds of security breaches like denial of service attacks. So if I want to send basically an unlimited stream of data right now to any particular IP address on the internet, there's really nothing that prevents me from doing that in an architectural sense. My ISP might notice that I'm doing that somehow if they're allowed to look at the data streams that come out of my computer, which is unclear given the privacy rules that the FCC just passed. But if they notice that I was just sending a enormous amount of data to to some website somewhere, and that maybe 500 other people within the area were doing the same thing, and there was no particular reason for us to be doing that, they could turn us off. But there's nothing in the architecture of TCP or UDP or of the internet generally that addresses that problem.
So going to the recent denial of service attack that Dyn was part of the problem, you had, let's say you knew that it was the IP number was actually just a baby monitor.
Mm-hmm.
If you knew, would there be the ability to somehow turn that off if you could recognize it somewhere in the process?
Mm-hmm.
And say,
well, and so what happened with the Dyn attack, right, was that there were just a bunch of domain DNS lookups. Like it was every individual data stream that was going to dine was making a perfectly legitimate request, like give me the information about domain, about, you know, Bennett.com, for example, and domain would have to answer with a fairly voluminous response. So that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. There's no reason for the internet to disable that. But millions of devices were doing that at the same time, and they're also doing it repetitively. And so it's kind of the repetitive nature of it and the widespread nature of it that made it an attack. We want the internet to be open and free, right? And we want the ISPs and the transit networks to just sort of pass traffic through. That's net neutrality. You know, it's, you keep a blind eye and you just pass it through. You don't want them to be obstructing people's use of the internet, right? And these are perfectly legitimate activities. So you have to invoke the network management exception to net neutrality to say, well, in the interests of network management, you should really look for attacks, and maybe you can do something about it if you want to, but you don't really have to. So Bob's looking at this thing in a completely different way, which is that instead of having this completely, utterly permissionless system where I can make a query to DNS and I can find all the technical information I need in order to deliver an unlimited stream of data to any destination on the internet, to any baby monitor, any website, any news organization, or any, you know, light controller, without anything further, if it's all sort of out there, then, you know, we have today's status quo. But if we could turn this around so that instead of before, the only prerequisite for an internet transmission being a lookup, as long as I have the IP address that belongs to Google.com, I can do anything with that I want. I think Bob's envisioning a system in which the decision about whether to give me the information that I need in order to access Google.com doesn't come from a local service that is managed by my ISP. It actually comes from Google itself. And so if I had to go, if only Google could actually answer my query, my DNS lookup for Google.com, and they can answer it with instead of an actual address, it was sort of a handle or a token or something that had a limited lifespan, then, and they noticed that I was sending abusive traffic, they could revoke it. And today's system doesn't allow that to happen, but I think this is what Bob has in mind.
So it creates a validation kind of gateway that you can, after a certain period of time, you'd have to revalidate. And it wouldn't be that everyone would have to do that system, but those who choose to have that in place, that would allow them to have a layer of protection.
But yeah, I mean, people that care about, protection from denial of service attacks could set that to a shorter interval. And once an attack is underway, it might actually, you know, the interval could go to zero. I mean, you know, you could remove yourself or make it, you know, difficult for the attackers to get to you.
That's an interesting way of trying to put some sort of cybersecurity measure into a system that the great thing about it is the open architecture, yet the downfall is the open architecture.
Well, and I think we have to understand, I mean, the system that sort of goes all the way from, like, you know, Ethernet pipes, fiber with running Ethernet to IP to TCP, that's pretty much okay. I mean, that's not really where the problems are. The problems are that it's incomplete. I mean, that's all perfectly fine, but then we ended that infrastructure architecture work with DNS. And DNS is really not fine. DNS, it has an assumption behind it that everyone is going to be a good actor. And, you know, there was a time when the internet was a research network and the only people who could use it were, you know, professors and graduate students and people who had been explicitly given permission by professors and graduate students and network administrators. And we knew who everyone was, so we didn't have to have any technical tools for preventing you know, Russian hackers from getting into John Podesta's email because there weren't any Russian hackers, right? They were just excluded from the system completely. And then we opened it up to the public in the mid-90s, and we let everyone in the world come in on the same terms that had been created for a closed community. And obviously, when you have an open community, you need to have more restrictive terms of behavior than when you had a closed community. So, I mean, the fact that we don't all know each other and that, you know, there are like, what, 4 billion people using the internet today? We're never going to know each other. We can't know each other. There aren't enough brain cells. We have to have some restrictions on, you know, where you essentially have to earn trust. And so everybody had trust in the beginning because they were members of this closed community. But yeah, we have to provide, I think, a graduated concept of trust. So yeah, everybody can do certain basic things, but if you want to get into the realm of sending enormous amounts of traffic or getting access to confidential information, you're going to have to prove, you know, that you are who you say you are and that you're accountable.
That could be something they could do with something like .bank. They could decide that you could have, you'd need to know who everyone is in the process. They mm-hmm. would have to authenticate into it. And you could certainly do that for other points in the .dot system as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's an excellent development, right? And it's always been, I mean, I understand the argument that, you know, free speech and people that want to support dissidents and whistleblowers, you know, say there's tremendous value in anonymity that you know, if the system doesn't support anonymity, it's not really good for much, but there are downsides to come with that.
Well, yeah, I guess you could still be anonymous, but you'd have to be a known anonymous. in if you choose to be in one of those systems, once I'm in the system and my bank knows who I am, that doesn't mean that every bank has to know who I am.
Right.
But the ones that I want to do business with know who is attached to that account number.
Yeah, and so you can be anonymous, but as long as someone who is not anonymous is willing to vouch for you.
Yes.
And so it's kind of like anonymous sources reporting things to newspaper reporters. I mean, and they can, you know, they can, Edward Snowden got hold of some information that he wasn't actually technically authorized to get a hold of, but he was able to do it. He went through a series of reporters and, you know, got it published and caused lots of interesting implications. And there's a connection, isn't there, between Snowden and the timing for some of these efforts to tighten up the security of the internet as a global system and reduce the American role?
Well, those are, I think, two little different things. One was to get the U.S. government out of the system because they were upset with the U.S. government in the Snowden incident and thinking that they were spying on the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a catalyst to remove the Department of Commerce from the IANA function.
Mm-hmm.
The IANA function itself, as we discussed, is really just very technical. So the idea that we needed to remove the U.S. government had been a long time in the process that was part of the original white paper in 1999. Unfortunately, the removal of the U.S. government didn't seem to make the other countries that had been complaining about this happy, which goes back to what we were talking about with the IoT meeting. So that it happened, and then they continued to say, we don't want to use the U.S. version of DNS. So there's still an interest in looking at other ways to make the internet go. And our question is to just make sure that whatever it is, it's a process that we have access to and we agree to have the networks use. And the Internet of Things certainly gives us an opportunity to design this with more thought into the process than the old internet that was using freedom of speech and content issues, because you're now going to have devices that are attached to it. And I think that gives us an opportunity to figure out how we're going to add security into the system. So Snowden might have gotten us into this awkward situation. I'm not sure. I think his role is over. And now we need to be thoughtful about how we're going to design the networks going forward. So we need more people like you involved, Richard.
You know, the internet kind of works. I mean, it limps along. It lets us down. It's actually pretty amazing what we can do with it. There are researchers, have always been researchers, who've identified shortcomings and have suggested ways to improve the architecture to make it more secure and more resilient and more efficient or whatever. But until there's some sort of crisis point, then these great ideas, there's no reason to disrupt the system in order to test these new ideas. But yeah, the Snowden event, I think, I'm not sure that much came of that really, because it's kind of fizzled out now. So perhaps these IoT attacks can serve as an impetus to improve the overall technical character of the internet. At least it's got people talking about that subject again, and the recognition is that if it was so easy for one person to marshal 100,000 IoT devices to slam traffic at Dyn DNS to the point where they couldn't actually function, yeah, there's something here that, you know, that we can look at. And so this political fight about, does IANA have oversight from NTIA, or is it potentially going to come under the control of Russia and China? That's not really pertinent to the, I mean, there are issues, there are security issues that need to be addressed. The current architecture and operational norms of the internet aren't adequate to do that. We need to address those issues in some way, and the role of the Department of Commerce is really pretty much nothing.
Well, it's definitely no much. It's not stronger now than any other government, which is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
The real key is making sure that you have no one government that is able to overrule how anyone runs the system.
Mm-hmm.
I always say that the internet is a really amazing, you know, it's created a digital economy that has been fantastic. I think all of us who are probably listening to this podcast really enjoy using it. And what we don't want to have is one entity that is able to overrule someone else and make the internet not cool.
Well, and I think that there is an element of the IANA transition that is probably was misunderstood, I think, by some of the politicians who made an issue out of this. The GAC.
Yes, the Government Advisory Committee.
Right. And what isn't understood is the fact that all that GAC can do is make recommendations. It can only make recommendations with absolutely unanimous consent of all the government. So all the governments have a representative on GAC, right?
All that choose to show up. There's about 140 countries, so most of the majors are
okay.
there.
So they can, if it's unanimous, they can make a recommendation. However, ICANN doesn't have to follow that recommendation if they don't want to.
So there's
two things
there.
Strictly advisory. It's like, yeah, it's just as the name says, Government Advisory Committee. They can make advice, but they can't force ICANN to follow it. Right?
So the Government Advisory Committee, the GAC, will then put their advice towards the ICANN board, and then the ICANN board can choose to take the advice, get more information about the concern, or they can say, thank you very much, but we're going to move forward. We don't see this to be an issue.
And for Russia and China to take over ICANN, then they'd somehow need to take over the ICANN board.
Yes.
So GAC wouldn't allow them to do that because the one dissenting vote from the U.S. would nullify the advice. But aren't there restrictions on how many members different regions of the world can have on the ICANN board?
So there are they try to be representational. Otherwise, we would have the challenge of we'd have a lot of North Americans and Northern Europeans on it. And so they're always trying to make sure that there's a balance of both hemispheres and all the different regions. So that would then hopefully keep the counterbalance to somebody like Russia and China.
Well, is that in the bylaws?
They're working on it being in the bylaws.
Okay. And so I guess the kind of Bond villain takeover, you'd have to change the bylaws, change the board, and then enact it. But if you could do all that, it wouldn't really make that much difference whether NTIA was involved or not, right? I mean, because they could decide, well, we're just going to ignore NTIA. And it's not like NTIA can actually, there's no key or there's no piece of physical hardware, there's no property that NTIA ever had that could, you know, prevent some kind of a takeover by foreign powers. It was because it's a system that runs on consensus.
True.
Okay. So yeah, the fears that of a Chinese and Russian takeover are probably overblown. The claims that by taking NTIA to the process, we would get peace and harmony and love and understanding throughout the international community. Well, turns out those weren't really true either. So we don't have, it's not Woodstock, you know, for the rest of the world.
We're going to have to find a new boogeyman. Yes.
And, well, so So IoT security, is that going to be the new boogeyman?
I think so. I think we can use that process for a good outcome rather than evil.
Yeah, okay. So if it brings some attention to the security questions and forces us to consider some of the alternative architectures from the internet, I think that would be a really good thing.
I think it'd be a very healthy exercise for us to do, especially at this point in time.
Isn't it amazing in politics how sometimes the right things happen for the wrong reasons?
It happens all the time.
And that's the only thing that sort of keeps us alive, I think.
Okay. Well, always interesting to talk to you, Richard.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Shane. I really enjoyed this, and I'm hoping that the listeners will learn as much from it as I have, and be glad to have you on again as either an interviewer or an interviewee.
I look forward to it.
So, High Tech Forum podcast, folks, that's what you've just listened to. If you got it from iTunes, please give us a write-up or a recommendation. Thumbs ups and love and understanding keeps us in business here. And we'll be back in another couple of weeks with another edition of the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm Richard Bennett.